Shire is a leading global specialty biopharmaceutical company with a focus on helping people with life-altering conditions to lead better lives. While Shire's portfolio of ADHD medicines helps patients diagnosed with ADHD, we recognize the need to provide additional support to them and their families. And that's why we at Shire value our local, regional, and international partnerships that are designed to develop and enhance programs to improve the understanding and awareness of ADHD. At Shire, people diagnosed with ADHD have our full attention. To learn more about Shire, visit www.shire.com.
To Attention Talk Radio, the show centered around paying attention to attention, with your host, Attention Coach Jeff Copper.
Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Attention Talk Radio. It is the night before Thanksgiving, or Thanksgiving Eve, I guess, in the United States. For our international listeners, it's a celebration here of our founding fathers. More importantly tonight, what I'm excited about is we have Dr. Russ Ramsey in the house, actually in our virtual studio, and our topic tonight is organizing and putting the ADHD treatments into a context we can all understand. This actual topic was suggested to me by one of our loyal fans, and I'm thrilled to actually kind of follow through. Actually, some of our best topics now are actually becoming recommendations from those of our listeners. Just a few announcements before we get into some details. A reminder to everybody out there that we're running a little raffle contest, kind of promoting our new Facebook page. If you go to facebook.com/attentiontalkradio, if you're a Facebook person, please go like us. The page is built. It's kind of unique. You can actually see our upcoming shows. You can actually access archive shows. You can listen to this show live. But with regard to the contest, if you click on the advertisers and giveaways, there's a little form. You fill out some information right there. No purchase necessary, and you can enter to win a $50 iTunes gift certificate. The deadline is November the 30th, so it's next week. So if you haven't done so, go check that out. The form that we're completing, we're trying to get to know our listeners a little bit and get some demographic information and stuff for our advertisers, so that's what that's all about. Let's see. Do I have any other major announcements? Don't think so for right now. The 2011 CHAD conference is in our rearview mirror right now. If you didn't go, you can go to chadd.org and get some information. I think you can actually can buy some of the audio and or videos of many of the presentations that were really pretty exciting. So if you missed that, you should check that out. But let's get into the show today. Dr. Ramsey, first of all, let me welcome you to the show.
Jeff, it's great to be back. It's always fun to spend some time with you.
Yeah, Dr. Ramsey's been with us on two other shows. The last one was in May, talking about alternative treatments to ADDA, like non-medication. And he also was with us in February of this year, talking about the history of ADHD. And the thing about you, Russ, is you're such a great answer. It's such a thrill, and you were just such the perfect person for this particular topic tonight. I do want to make everybody aware that you're co-director at the University of Pennsylvania Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program and Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology and Psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you have – can you tell us a little bit about your books?
Sure. I've got two books. The first one published with the other co-director and co-founder of the Penn ADHD program, my psychiatrist colleague, Dr. Tony Rothstein. It was Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Adult ADHD, an Integrative Psychosocial and Medical Approach, focusing on primarily our psychosocial treatment, our psychotherapy model for treating ADHD and how we integrate it in with medications. And then the more recent book was a book-length review of non-medication treatments for adults with ADHD. So reviewing the psychosocial treatments, some of the academic treatments, complementary alternative, and a bunch of other treatments I reviewed filled up the other chapters.
If one of our listeners want to get a copy of the book, what's the best place to do? Is Amazon?
Amazon's always a very useful one. The first book, the Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Adult ADHD book, was published by Routledge. It's a Taylor and Francis group. And the second book, The Non-Medication Treatments for Adult ADHD, was published by the American Psychological Association. And we may be doing a second edition, a revised edition of the first book in the coming year. It might be our New Year's resolution. We'll have to see.
There you go. There you go. Actually, I need to think about doing a show on New Year's resolutions. I haven't done that one yet. So, well, everybody, I want to tell you that to our listeners, this is a very different show from what I've done in the past. I have been privileged enough to be the host of the show and bring on a host of experts, for the last couple years. And when our listeners had emailed me about, you know, I'm overwhelmed with all this stuff, I try to put it in a little bit of a context that I can understand. And I put a couple bullet points, and I actually shared this with Dr. Ramsey. Now, we haven't talked about this, but I put it together in like a little bit of a format. I'm going to outline it for you, and I want to walk through this. And I'm really looking for Dr. Ramsey to kind of help me fine-tune what's going on to see if any of this makes sense. Or all I know, this could be a bust and I could be completely wrong, or maybe I've actually kind of got the mark. But the outline that we have is, first, at the top, we're going to talk about treatment really begins with getting the right diagnosis, because if your diagnosis is incorrect, then you're paying attention to the wrong thing. I think you guys have heard me say that before. If you're not paying attention to the right thing, it's wrong. We want to talk about the treatments that impact your physical brain. That's the kind of like the gray matter. And then like the mindful, the thoughtful brain. That's the ideas and thoughts. And then we're going to talk into another area of exercise and neuroplasticity, and then like kind of an ad hoc at the end. And again, I could be completely wrong on this, and I'm gonna let Dr. Ramsey correct me on this, but I'm hoping I can put this in a context where we can kind of help you understand it. So let's start with the top. Dr. Ramsey, in my discussions with the experts on the show, one of the keys, from what I understand, is actually getting the proper diagnosis. And it sounds to me like many people, and many times, they're not getting the right diagnosis. Is that? Can you share your thoughts on this?
Sure. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think the diagnosis of ADHD is one of those that, for many people, can bring a lot of clarity. I mean, there are several others that I've encountered like that. One could be if somebody's experiencing panic attacks but doesn't know what they are. The panic mm-hmm. attacks gives a nice cognitive reframe, understanding of what's going on that finally helps make sense of it. Now, it doesn't necessarily cure it in and of itself, but having a name and understanding that the name really reflects the syndrome that resonates for the person. It doesn't feel foreign. It's like, yes, that's me. That's what mm-hmm. I'm trying to explain to people. And I think ADHD does that because I think by its nature, ADHD is a collection of symptoms that result in maddening inconsistency in day-to-day life. I think Russ Barkley said at one time, like, kids with ADHD, they have two good days in a row and it's held against them the rest of their life.
Meaning,
well, of course, look, he studied, he was able to read all the chapters, do all his homework last weekend. Why can't he do it this weekend? That's ADHD. It's the difficulty organizing these things, making and executing plans over time. And that's mm-hmm. the insidious nature of it and the frustrating nature. So I think you're right on that, starting off with that diagnosis, the understanding of what's going on. And it's not always that diagnoses are totally wrong. They may be incomplete, like we're picking up part of it. So there may be some mild depression or anxiety or some other issue, like a marital issue for adults, that gets somebody in the door, and ADHD is playing a role, but it's sort of the silent influence that's in the room that nobody's acknowledging. Not ignoring it, just not recognizing, oh, yeah, that makes sense, why the spouse, the partner, isn't following through on the other partner's requests. It's not, you know, expressing aggression or anger towards the person. It's that they honestly forgot because they're not writing it down, because they thought in an honest way, well, I'll remember it, this is important, but then something else leads to distraction and lack of follow-through.
What struck me, what you just said, maddening inconsistency.
Maddeningly inconsistent.
Wow. I'll be posting about that one tomorrow on Facebook. That's madly inconsistent. One of the things that was struck me, and everybody out there, if you want to dial back, November 2nd, I interviewed Dr. Charles Parker, and I also, back in March the 30th, interviewed Dr. Michael Linden. On QEEGs as a way to like do brain scans to diagnose. And Dr. Parker, we talked about trying to find the right physician. But one of the things that I've learned from both of those is that there's a lot of things that actually look like ADD when they're not. So imagine if you're sleep deprived for a period of time. If you're sleep deprived, it's difficult to wake up the next day and actually kind of pay attention. So if you were to walk in and not discuss that with your mental health professional, it'd be easy why you could describe your life as such to get a misdiagnosis. And it's something as simple as you don't have ADD. You're just not sleeping very well. It can be sleep apnea.
Right. But you know what? When we're looking at it with sleep apnea, and I was just at another conference, the APSARD conference, the American Professional Society of ADHD and Related Disorders, and we had a wonderful presentation by Craig Sermon of Harvard, who's has a wide range of interests and a wide range of research talking about that. And very often with some sort of sleep disturbance, such as sleep apnea, there's mm-hmm. a pretty clear onset. Like there may be a change in weight or some other physical change where there's a more discrete onset, not 100% of the time, but where we can see a pre-sleep difficulty or pre-sleep apnea difficulty where if there is ADHD in addition to sleep apnea, we would expect to see some signs and symptoms of ADHD earlier on. If there were no signs and symptoms and then the sleep difficulty began, then we would start, as you were just alluding to, taking a look at this is a primary sleep disturbance. What's that phrase? All that glitters is not gold and all mm-hmm. that is inattentive is not ADHD. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. And the other frustrating thing is, individuals with ADHD very often report some degree of sleep disturbance. Now, it may be procrastinating on sleep. Mm-hmm. I'm very tired, but it's very quiet. I can get a lot of work done. They may be busy liking your website on Facebook at 3 a.m.
Yep.
Rather than trying to go to sleep. So I think the sleep assessment and just encouraging people to get a good medical workup at the beginning just to rule out either other medical causes for attentional difficulties, or it's not a bad idea, even if we agree that this is primarily ADHD, all these other things, such as some of the things on your list, like having the thyroid checked out or just
yep.
overall physical health, these may not be considered interventions for ADHD, but anything we can do to help the brain, help our body, is going to help nudge our attention, our impulse control, our self-regulation in the right direction.
And just to kind of split this apart, what you kind of said, there's one side of it is make sure you don't have sleep apnea. The other side
right.
of it is like if you have ADHD can create some sleep problems, which, by the way, we had Roberta Olivardi on back in February 9th, I guess, on the show, talking about those particular issues, which we're going to talk about in a second with regard to maintenance of the brain. The point, really, I want to make at the top of it is you got to get that Swiss Army knife, and you got to dissect and make sure this is actually what you've got here. And if it's ADD and or understand that maybe you have ADHD and dyslexia, because like 60%
right.
of the time ADHD walks kind of with something, they call it comorbid. I don't like the name comorbid conditions,
right.
but there's a lot of other stuff there. So the idea is before you start this process and you want to manage it, you need to really understand what you're dealing with.
Right, and that's part of that personal, what we call the psychoeducation, not just understanding that you have ADHD, it's understanding your ADHD, and if it is tethered to something such as dyslexia, or even if it's not something formal like that, if it simply means it takes me longer to read written material than it might for somebody else, because some people, they may report, I'm on time for things, but when I'm meeting somebody, because that makes it salient enough, for other people that's not salient enough, and they say I'm late all the time. But even the person who is on time and pretty organized in the schedule says, once I leave the presence of somebody and go to work on something on my own, I have a hard time following through. So there really is ADHD takes a lot of different forms for different individuals, so it's really important for each person to understand their individual profile in addition to any coexisting features such as if there's anxiety, low mood, learning differences, whatnot.
It's funny because I did a show, I don't have it in front of me, with Dan Pruitt back in, I think, October of 2009, and it really speaks to what you're saying, Dr. Ramsey, about, well, there's two things. One, if you watch the documentary ADD and Loving It, I forget the guy who on it says, if you've seen a person with ADHD, you've seen one person with ADHD, and the point really is that they're all different.
Right.
But the show that I did with Dan back in October of 2009 was, I had seen him somewhere, if you've got inattentive, there's like, you have to have six symptoms out of nine, and
right.
and hyperactive, and was the same, and combined is 12 out of 18. If you went through all the possible mathematical combinations, it calculated out to be 18,000 different versions of ADHD, which didn't take into consideration severity or other conditions. And I think that your point is really good here, is that your ADHD is probably different from everybody else. You need to get the right diagnosis and really kind of understand your form of it in order to kind of move forward.
Correct, and just add one more piece to it. We're talking about a developmental syndrome, so it'll look different when you're in middle school versus college versus the workplace versus raising a child. We have to understand it in context. So, you know, whatever your life circumstances, things may look a little different. Some people hold it together at work, but then when they get home, they've expended so much energy holding it together at work, the complaints are coming from home, or vice versa. Somebody may be pretty good at home with the home projects, but having greater difficulty with work, or for some people it's, you know, both aspects of life, or some other aspect of life is
suffering.
It
was fascinating because I sat at a CHAD conference, was like just right around the corner. I sat on a lecture that Barclay did, and he was talking about exactly what you were talking about. It's a developmental type thing, and you need to compare people to the peers, which the DSM doesn't necessarily do. And he's
right.
making a call for, hey, listen, you know, you got to compare a developmentally a 16-year-old to a 16-year-old and a 30-year-old to a 30-year-old really to understand this. So, Dr. Ramsey, we need to kind of run to a break. Before we do, for anybody who's listening to the show who has questions or want to get in contact with you, is the best way to go to your website or send you an email?
The best way is the email. I think if you access the website, you can get to my faculty page and get my email. But let me quick give it to you. It's my last name, Ramsey, R-A-M-S-A-Y, at mail, M-A-I-L, dot med, M-E-D, dot UPenn dot edu.
All right, with that, but we'll be right back.
Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio.
ADHD, is it real? How is it diagnosed? How do I know if I have it or if my children have it? Do you outgrow it? You have questions and we have answers. We're CHAD, a national organization made up of professionals, parents, educators, and of course, those with ADHD. So if you want real answers to your questions, join CHAD at www.chadd.org or call us at 800-233-4050.
You deserve the best-trained ADHD coach. Find one at the ADD Coach Academy, the only comprehensive ADHD coach training program accredited by the International Coach Federation. Go to addca.com and click on Find a Coach.
Has your child been diagnosed with ADHD? Is he not fulfilling his potential? Success in Mind can help. We provide assessments that identify a student's learning profile of strengths and challenges. The result? A practical plan of strategies and tools that go beyond medication that parents, teachers, and students can implement together. If your child needs more success, visit Success in Mind at www.success-in-mind.org.
Make every moment count with Time Timer, a sensitive solution for ADHD time management. It shows how much time is left using a bright red disc that gets smaller as time passes. To place an order for a Time Timer, all you have to remember is timetimer.com.
News, updates, and alerts sent right to your inbox. Sign up now at attentionradio.com.
You're listening to Attention Talk Radio.
And now, back to the show.
Welcome back, everybody. I got Dr. Russ Ramsey in the house. We're talking about ADHD treatments, trying to put them in a context we can all understand. Before the break, we were really talking about the importance of getting the right diagnosis before you even kind of start this process in terms of treatment. And I want to kind of get into that in a second. But before I do, real quickly, I want to give a little shout-out to our Twitter followers out there. That would be Beth, Jason, Canada, Rebecca, Mary Lou, Pale, and if everybody forgive me, my dyslexia is going to jump in here because I didn't rehearse this, but A.M. Berlitz, so forgive me if I'm botching this, Rachel, Anna, Rebel Dolly, Devon, Jody Sleeper, Madeline, and Brandon. So again, everybody, thank you very much for following our show, retweeting, and mentioning us out there. We really appreciate it. Dr. Ramsey, in trying to understand treatments, I think people kind of come bombarded, and the list that I had kind of sent you is I kind of tried to put these in kind of categories to understand. One was the category I'd like to kind of talk about. Those are the things that impact the physical brain. It's kind of like the gray matter, not the thoughtful, mindful brain,
right,
but the things that kind of deal with just the mechanical side of the brain. And I guess I want to ask you, before we get into this, is this delineation, does this make some sense? Is it rational to sit there and say, hey, listen, there's some things that are designed to optimize the physical brain, and then there's other things that we need to talk about, the thoughtful, mindful brain, the belief systems, and that part of the mind that, or brain, mind, whatever, we kind of lump those things together that is kind of nebulous that we're still really trying to get our arms around?
No, it does make sense, because on the one hand, you had it delineated as the physical brain, or let's just call it brain health. And I think it makes sense. We were alluding to this before, even with the diagnosis, getting a medical workup just to check about how the body in general is doing, and the brain being one organ of the body, taking a look at how different aspects of brain functioning, the neurochemistry, can affect what the brain is doing, what it attends to, its ability to self-regulate. And one of the things you mentioned is, and I don't think we know enough about, I think there's some research going on, just even some hormonal changes for women across the lifespan. And we can go back to males or females at puberty, but also women perimenopausal or going through menopause. We certainly, I think, clinically, anecdotally would say, yes, this phase has some effects that make attention even more challenging, but in terms of what to do about it or how to factor that in, and just the normal course of aging for older adults, how do we differentiate the presence of ADHD from any cognitive decline that may be associated with the normal course of aging? It's really hard to differentiate, but we would imagine there is some interplay there. So, I mean, taking care of the brain in terms of its, overall health, addressing any, environmental allergies, food allergies, even if we say based on the current scientific evidence, these are often not severe enough to create ADHD, if you will, the wide-ranging self-regulation, but if they're present, they don't help. And then if we can treat those symptoms, or in some cases, in children, very often children with ADHD, but also adults, if there is documented food allergies, if there is some benefit, food restriction diets can be very challenging to organize and maintain and should be done under a physician's care. But some simple things, if you know you're allergic to a food, not taking that food in, these are, I think Dr. Eugene Arnold talked about, these are sort of the grandparent suggestions, the grandmother
mm-hmm.
suggestions
mm-hmm.
for good health.
So when I align this in my work with people, let's just take, like, keeping the brain in tune. The idea here really is that let's talk about sleep for a second. If you have difficulty paying attention,
yeah.
If you have that and you're sleep deprived, it is magnified.
Absolutely.
Hence to me, the paying attention to sleep and getting good sleep is probably more important to somebody with ADHD. The idea really is that that in order for your mind to work correctly, to achieve what you want to do, that you need to optimize sleep. You have less of a capacity to deal with sleep deprivation than the average person, so it needs to be a heightened sense of awareness.
Is that one of these foundational, if you will, interventions or things to pay attention to? And very often, many adults with ADHD, as we alluded to before, may have a coexisting sleep problem like sleep apnea.
Yep.
But very often, we'll see what I'll call just psychosocial sleep difficulties, behavioral sleep difficulties, procrastinating on sleep. And then what happens, there becomes this belief or this self-view of, well, I'm a night person. I've been that way. And we're really talking about a sleep stage shift to this person doesn't start getting tired until 2 a.m., and then if they procrastinate and then they sleep until 11, and let's just say they have a 10 o'clock class, have to get to work at 9, they're going to be under-functioning. Part of the work, be it in coaching, psychosocial treatment, or somebody's self-change efforts, is to get the sleep regulated, get back on what's called a morning or a daytime orientation.
Mm-hmm. So these types of things are affecting the physical brain that can impact kind of what's going on. It's important to pay attention to some of that stuff and to manage it if you want to function at your optimal level.
Right. Now, are we going to say that a week's worth of 8-hour sleep each night, is that going to cure ADHD? No, but it certainly makes it's going to put you on the right track and set a good foundation for being able to exert more energy towards positive coping, and you're going to get the most out of whatever treatment you're involved in, be it a behavioral treatment, medication treatment,
or whatnot. That speaks exactly to my point. This is the gray matter we're trying to optimize. What we're going to get to in a second with the mind, because if it's inhibited, it's almost like a kind of computer. If the hardware is, if you got a computer from the 1980s, you're not going to be able to optimize this stuff. So you need to keep it running efficiently as possible in order for you to achieve your mission.
Or another metaphor: if you have hypertension and you're on a wonderful medication for hypertension, it doesn't mean you can drink all the caffeine you want and not pay attention to diet. You can optimize whatever benefits you get out of the medication by paying attention to your stress level, to your diet. It'll make all these things work together better.
Excellent. So we have sleep, which we're going to fine-tune. We also have exercise, which is another thing that I've heard and I understand, and more, as an aside, I haven't done a show on exercise because I keep kind of going back and forth. There's a very, very well-known athlete. At one point in time, they were ready to come on the show, but I have a well-known author on the topic of exercise who couldn't do it. And then when the author could do it, the athlete couldn't do it.
Right.
But exercise is a – which, by the way, I'm a swimmer, everybody. That's a clue. I swam – I was coached by Doc Councilman, who coached Mark Spitz, who won 7 gold medals.
Right.
End of clues. But – the point really is in terms of optimizing the brain, exercising has an impact on the physical side of the brain as well, correct?
Absolutely, and it has a very positive impact. In fact, that becomes part of many people's coping repertoire, is to have whatever degree of exercise works for them. Some people, it may be a very intense aerobic workout. For other people, it may be a brisk walk. But almost to a person, anecdotally, it certainly helps, and I think we have a fair amount of research that says it is helpful. Again, is it going to, how long do the gains persist? It's not like an hour jog in the morning is going to help you pay attention better later in the day, but it does set things up. It takes care of the body. It takes care of the mind, and again, it can magnify the positive effects of other interventions you're using. And it also, me being a psychologist and focusing on the cognitive behavioral treatment, it helps structure the day. Are you going to do this task that you have to do before you exercise or after you exercise? It gives an anchor point.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
When you exercise, does it chemically change the brain?
Yes.
It does.
The short answer is yes, and I think this comes from probably the author you were talking about is John Rady. He had a book called Spark, where he reviewed not just for ADHD, it was also for depression, substance use. And he also had a wonderful book several years ago called The User's Guide to the Brain, where he would talk about I think he, and probably metaphorically, but talked about the benefits of exercise in terms of, hey, it's probably worth this many milligrams of this medication during the time you're doing it. Just to put it in those terms to say, yes, you're having a positive effect, you know, on the brain.
This is fascinating to me, and we're going to kind of come back to this in a couple different ways, but you're right. It's John Ray that I've been talking to, and everybody, it's Michael Phelps' agents I've been talking to, and I hope to bring that show about. But what's interesting to me is Rob Tedesco is he kind of is the president of the EDGE Foundation, and we've had Rob on the show, and they're very involved in trying to bring ADHD scholarships and stuff. And Rob actually ran the New York City Marathon, and he actually, as a practicing attorney, will acknowledge that he uses exercise as a way to kind of help manage and control his ADHD. And it's fascinating to me because if you're what I'm hearing you say, Dr. Ramsey, is if you exercise, it chemically changes the brain, and if it can actually help you kind of pay attention, Rob is saying he does it in such a way, or timing-wise, so that he can focus at work.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think
this is
a lot
real,
of people
right?
will do it in as part of their preparation for entering into school, the workplace. In fact, a colleague of mine told me, I don't have independent verification of this, but it's a trusted source, that in some schools in Scandinavia, they're actually having students doing their studies, doing their homework on slow-moving treadmills, so that they're in motion in order to enhance their focus as they're reading, as they're doing work.
And I have to tell you, I have coached at least five people in my lifetime where we got the concept of getting the desk and raising it up so they don't sit, they stand,
right.
and they can move while they're either reading or they're doing some stuff, because that there's the physical movement, which is not, is it exercise or not, it's movement, but for these particular people it seems to help them focus.
Right. So it doesn't have to be, again, it doesn't have to be running the marathon. In some ways we're talking about motion, and you know, if I think Russ Barkley, he would talk about when we understand the executive functions, some of the things that we're very often asking kids to do don't make sense, such as extended time on tests. You know, this child may have difficulty focusing on the test for however long, so are we going to have them take it longer? He had the notion of, well, how about time off the test? It's almost like you can take a time out, stop the clock on the test, get up, walk around, then when you're ready to start, the clock starts again, so you have an hour on the test without having to sit there for 60 minutes straight. And, you know, it sounds like, are we going to make children sit still for a long time, or let them stand up so they can move around a little bit? It doesn't mean they're running from wall to wall, but just a little shifting around to, you know, help, if you will, burn off a little bit of the hyperactivity enough so it doesn't become too distracting that it interferes with work.
Absolutely.
It's a common sense accommodation.
Well, I have to pause right now because I clearly underestimated the amount of time that we need to kind of cover this. Dr. Ramsey, can you go up to 9 o'clock?
I'm with you, brother.
All right. So, and by the way, everybody, we are not going to cover this stuff. So, Dr. Ramsey, I have to have you come back. It's like opening a can of worms. I've wanted to do the show for absolutely forever, but this is such great material. What we're going to do is we're going to extend some stuff. We're going to do a break in a couple minutes because I want to complete the physical brain, and we'll go into this other stuff, and we're going to deal with the end of it while we can. Another area that I want to talk about is nutrition. I hear about omega-3 fish oils, protein for breakfast, those types of things. Again, when I've been interviewing advertisers, sponsors, and people, it seems to me that these are not cures for ADHD. These are the ideas so that your physical brain is working optimally. And the fish oils and the protein, particularly for breakfast, among other things, it's just good brain food. So that your brain is alive, it's ready to go, and it's optimally in the best way it can.
Right.
Is that an accurate statement, Dr.
Yes,
Ramsey?
In fact, with the omega-3 fatty acids, the fish oils, there's actually been a recent review of several studies of that, primarily for children with ADHD, that appeared in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, in which there were consistent moderate findings that, you know, the omega-3 fatty acids did help improve some of the symptoms of ADHD in these younger folks, children, and maybe young adolescents. So there we have a little stronger evidence base that that helps out a bit. Again, we don't, in terms of how well it generalizes, we don't have a lot of data on that, but that would be considered a supplement that makes sense. And also, you can't do wrong because it also helps with cardiac health and also with mood. We have some stronger evidence for that. But this meta-analysis would suggest, yeah, there's solid ground for that supplementation. It's not, the effect sizes obviously weren't as strong as medications, but there could be some value added for a relatively easy-to-administer supplement. Protein for breakfast or for other meals just makes good sense. Mm-hmm. It just helps the brain work better. And in terms of gluten or other allergies, when there's a documented allergy to a food, obviously that can worsen attention features. So if you can gain some benefit from removing those substances from your diet, that's always a smart thing to do. And in some cases with other vitamins and minerals, when there's an obvious deficit in these vitamins or minerals, you know, augmenting them up until the point that you reach the baseline, there can be improvements, but then once you get them back to the levels they should be, the benefits pretty much go away because any difficulties come from the under-supplementation of these vitamins and minerals, which part of the thinking is folks with ADHD might be at a little higher risk for not paying as close attention to their diets.
Yep.
And maybe at more risk for not getting enough of these vitamins and minerals or other important nutrients.
Want to transition in from this. I want to talk about the stimulants for a second, because as we get into stimulants, it's a drug that you're taking that's altering the chemistry in your brain, which I'm still classifying as the physical part of the brain because it doesn't affect your belief system.
Correct.
Is that right? Does that make some sense to you?
Yes. I mean, in a nutshell, what the stimulants do primarily is allow more dopamine to be available in the synaptic cleft so that it can be, you know, taken up by the neurons, and that helps to, it's the reward neurotransmitter, which can help when we need to generate motivation for a task that's not inherently exciting, that it allows more in there so we can access it and improve the executive functions and be able to stick with the task longer.
So we're going to talk about the mind a little bit, cognitive behavioral therapy. We're going to talk about coaching, NLP, all that kind of stuff. But to relate it back to where we are, the idea is if you take the stimulants, it can help the symptoms, but it doesn't teach you how to get organized.
That's a great summary. The pills don't teach the skills is the phrase I've been hearing a lot.
They really don't. And this is what's fascinating to me is we had Dr. Charles Parker on at the earlier part of November, and we were talking about stimulants. And I had been dying to have somebody on because so many people I work with will take a stimulant, and they get frustrated after 2 months and they kind of give up. And we talked about the art of getting it right, because there's so much involved with getting the right meds. You have your immune system, digestive tract. There's hormones. We did a show January 8th of 2010 with Linda Rogley with women who are going that are postmenopausal,
right,
and those types of things affecting some of this stuff. And with stimulants, there's metabolism. There's so much of the physical body that the drugs have to go through in order to get to the brain to do what we want to do.
And we even heard, like, in some cases, like, grapefruit juice can undermine or weaken the effects of stimulants if they're, you know, if the stimulants are taken with grapefruit juice.
Great, really? I've never
yeah.
heard that. Grapefruit juice can inhibit that.
Yes.
So one of the things here is that, and before tonight I was talking about
to Dr. Ramsey about having him come on again about another show, because at CHAD they were talking about they're trying to educate internal medicine people. But one of the points really is that when you study this stuff, you got to realize that stimulants are affecting the physical part of the brain, but they have to go through the body, per Dr. Parker, in order to get to the mind. And if they're diluted and inhibited in any type of way, and that can be done by hormones, the digestive tract, the immune system, allergies, other types of drugs that you're taking at that point in time, that can all water down what's going on to impact the physical brain. Actually, I'm making that statement, Dr. Ramsey. Am I incorrect, or is that accurate?
Let's put it this way. You know, there's all kinds of brains out there. There's all kinds of bodies out there. So scientifically, we test a lot of people. So the medications, as they're prescribed, have the greatest likelihood of being the most effective for the widest range of people. However, you know, every brain is different. So most people will probably have a pretty normative response. What the doctor says, what the literature says, you know, you'll feel it. The medications start working after about this long. They'll last for about 4 to 6 hours, and then you'll feel it tailing off. But there will be some people where they might feel it sooner and it lasts shorter, other people a little longer. And with metabolism and some of these other factors, you know, we've had, I can think of one gentleman who came through our clinic. He probably, due to his rapid metabolism of stimulants, he had to take a high enough dose that would raise most physicians' concerns, but it was just his body would metabolize it so fast. If he didn't take that dose, he wouldn't get effects of it. So there are these exceptions to the rule. So many people will do just fine with them, but there are these other circumstances that might have to be taken into account.
So correct me if I'm wrong, because this has come up a lot. You have an ADHD kid, and and the meds seem to be working. All of a sudden, they start an aerobic sport like swimming, cross country, cycling, triathlons. Am I incorrect in saying that if they were to start that and they exercise, that their body will actually metabolize the medications quicker? And so by the time they get home, it's all been metabolized, and they're sitting down to their homework, and it's all worn off at that point in time because they're accelerated their body's processing of that particular drug?
That one I'm not as clear on, and also there's other factors such as any fatigue that can come from that or any hunger or some other physical aspects that could be affecting the brain and body that even if the stimulants are still working, might create some other interference with that. So that was one I'm a little out of my domain, but it would be something to be considered. And also, if we're talking about children and adolescents, any effects on body weight of this sort of aerobic exercise over the course of the season, and also we're at those developmental periods where in the course of 6 months or a year there might be a change in height and weight that might have to be accounted for in the dosing. So it is one of these things. It's a very dynamic process that needs to be monitored over time. But going back to your specific question, I wouldn't feel comfortable being a PhD answering the question about metabolism, even though it sounds like a reasonable hypothesis.
Reasonable hypothesis, but thank you very much. By the way, because I'm trying to sort my way through this stuff. It's not necessarily right or wrong, but the idea that it's a reasonable hypothesis, but the idea is you need to monitor it and talk to your mental health professional. So before I want to go to another break in a second, but we've been talking about the physical brain. There's one last thing that I kind of want to bring up that I had skipped over, and that is when it comes to the physical brain, we've talked about the digestive tract, hormones, other things, things to keep in tune, sleep, exercise, nutrition to kind of keep the brain working optimally, medications that will affect that stuff. I actually had Dr. Max Munke on in August talking about acupuncture. It was a fascinating discussion, and the show had come to me from a person in the UK
asking me to do a show on this, and Dr. Ramsey, you would actually refer me to Max. And when I had him on the show, I was kind of going through the process, and I had an aha in the middle of it. That is that if you're sticking a bunch of needles in my back, my brain chemistry is going to react to that somehow. And I was thinking that there's got to be a reaction. I don't know if it affects ADHD or not, but if I have exercise and it changes my brain chemistry, if I'm in an accident and it changes my brain chemistry through endorphins, why wouldn't that necessarily happen in acupuncture? I don't think there's a lot of science, a lot of research on this. Even Dr. Mooney acknowledged that there wasn't a lot of it. Can you just kind of give your comments on that space?
Right, right. And you know what? That was like one show I've been meaning to look up because I, when speaking with Max before, he had mentioned this was an area of interest, and he, you know, had some observations on it, and I hadn't heard much about it since, or you know, when I did the non-medication treatments book, didn't see too much on it. So, you know what? Most of what we do affects the brain. So I guess part of what we're looking at here is the types of changing we're making. Do they? And we're talking about the physical brain. Do they have effects that affect the physical brain in a way, in a manner that will improve, you know, ADHD, because there may be some things that we do that affect the brain, like if we laugh at a funny movie, we're affecting the brain. There's some neurochemistry changes, and we might say we're going to be more focused on the movie, but as soon as the movie isn't as funny, the gains do not persist. So I think part of the question is, much of what we do affects the brain. How well does it affect the self-regulation difficulties associated with ADHD? How much, if it does affect those in a positive way, how much does it move outside of ourselves and affect our behavior in day-to-day life, in domains that are important for us? And how long do these improvements last? So it's a grand, you know what, these are a lot of questions, and these are many of the questions asked of some of the alternative treatments and also some of the ones that are pretty well-founded. I think we're still asking those about the cognitive behavioral therapy. I mean, I would be very interested as an outcome measure in addition to the questionnaires that we use and observations of functioning in day-to-day life, which is probably the best measure, but I would love to see if we could do pre and post, you know, some sort of brain scan or other indication of, well, what's going on physically? Can we see these changes? So this is a grand, I don't know when it comes back to acupuncture, but these are some of the questions. You're right. You stick a needle somewhere in your body, you know, if you know that's not intended, yes, you're going to have a pain response, which affects the brain. If it's as part of this therapeutic acupuncture, it may have a different response, hopefully a positive response. But, you know, what's the long-range effect of that in terms of, like, ADHD? And I think with acupuncture, we just don't know yet, but it may be one of those that's useful to study more in a systematic way.
Well, it's fascinating to me because when I had been contacted, and I was doing the research, and you recommended me to contact Max, I did, and I had him on the show, and I had the aha in the middle of it that, hey, listen, if I'm getting stuck with a whole bunch of needles, my brain's going to react to it chemically. I was motivated, so I actually went myself to get acupuncture. But before I explain that, actually, I tell you what. Let's do this. I want to go to commercial break and come back because Russ, we're gonna have to do a sequel to this. This is
For trying to consolidate this into user friendly bite sized information, huh?
Absolutely. So I tell you what. Again, if you want to get hold of Dr. Ramsey, go to ramsay@mail.med.upenn.edu, and with that, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Attention Talk Radio. We'll return in a moment. Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio.
Make every moment count with Time Timer, a sensitive solution for ADHD time management. It shows how much time is left using a bright red disc that gets smaller as time passes. To place an order for a Time Timer, all you have to remember is TimeTimer.com.
Experience the difference with a top-notch ADHD coach. Find one at the ADD Coach Academy, the only comprehensive ADHD coach training program accredited by the International Coach Federation. Go to ADDCA.com and click on Find a Coach.
Do you have something those with ADHD need? Advertise on Attention Talk Radio. We are a narrowcast, internet-based radio show targeting those with or impacted by ADHD. To learn more about advertising opportunities, email attention at attentiontalkradio.com.
And now, back to Attention Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everybody, to this edition of Attention Talk Radio. I've got Dr. Russ Ramsey, and he has proven to me that this space that I'm trying to talk on, I got way more content than I got time. So what we're going to do is before the break, we were talking about acupuncture and Dr. Max Muenke. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to kind of talk about this and transition to what I hope, Dr. Ramsey, you'll come back and discuss a little bit more. And that is when I went to acupuncture, and I need to say this, is the Muenke episode was August the 10th. It was interesting because before the show I had talked to him. He was a Western trained physician with a lower back issue, and he had exhausted all the Western solutions to it. So
and
let me
just add, a very prominent scientist at the National Institute of Health.
No, thank you very much. So he turned at that point in time to acupuncture because he was a runner. He liked to run. And he went and got the acupuncture and was able to run a marathon after it was over with. And as he described, the second or third session he walked out, and he noticed a noticeable change in the way he was paying attention to the world. So it's funny because I've had lower back issues for a while. I went out and I did it, and I got to tell you something. I can't articulate it to you, but something was different. My acupuncturist had said, massage will relax the muscles and do something that's temporary. Acupuncture is extended a little bit longer, and it did, but it didn't feel like anything I had described. And it was fascinating to me because I'm still wrestling with there's a placebo effect, and that is, as I've described on the show forever, and everybody, I hope you know that I have a coaching bent to this stuff because that's my background. I call myself attention coach because what's obvious is a function of what you pay attention to. And I wanted it to work, and I always thought, do I feel this because I want it to, or is it actually real? And the reason I'm bringing this up is, in our next episode with Dr. Ramsey, if he comes on, we're going to talk about the mind because it has an awful lot to do with what you're paying attention to. And with regard to acupuncture, I found myself, interestingly enough, wanting it to work. But at the same time, I got to tell you, I experienced something that was very different that science might not be able to understand because in Max's case, he was able to run when it was over with that Western medicine couldn't explain. And I'm going to throw that stuff out there, and Dr. Ramsey, can you kind of comment? We'll wrap it up with this as a teaser to the next show.
Right, right. Well, you know what? And there's a placebo effect. There is a placebo effect. It's been reported even in studies of medications for ADHD. In fact, I think we see it a little bit more. The older the patient is into adulthood, we see a little bit more of a placebo effect. And, you know, so what is that? Well, that would be people in a study of one group gets the actual medication, a stimulant, say, and the other gets a sugar pill. Well, the people getting the sugar pill, similar to what you said, Jeff, want it to work, presumably, and then, you know, report improvements, even though there shouldn't be a biological reason. Now, so how do we explain that? Is there a biochemical change in the brain, does that lead people to try things behaviorally that they didn't believe they could do before, or maybe, like in the case of ADHD, persist with them more because they think they're doing better? And does the thought, in this case, of being on a medication, even though it's a placebo, make the person believe that they're doing better, and that enhances motivation? You know, I had an interesting experience with this a couple of weeks ago. It was the week before we turned our clocks back for the end of daylight savings time.
Uh-huh.
For some reason, I thought it was a week earlier, and so I went around our house turning all the clocks back. I woke up the next day, heard the news radio, and, you know, I thought I had an extra hour of sleep. I felt great, and, yeah, I actually got up a little early, and then I heard on the radio I was off by a week. But, you know, I felt like I had an extra hour of sleep because I told myself I did. So I think so again, this is going to be another grand I don't know, and this might, I'll even put it to a we don't know. And I don't think it's that we can't study it. I think it may be more, a little more challenging to study, and it's also difficult to have a good control group. So, like with medications, we can have two pills that look exactly the same. People take just as many of them. Just one is the active medication, the other is the sugar pill. I don't know how we would have the control for, you know, acupuncture, or maybe people put the needles in the wrong place where they're not supposed to go, and we can compare people that way. So I think it can be studied, but it's just a little more challenging. So, yeah, we don't know the long range of these, again, the power of beliefs, and what the, if you will, the active ingredient is with some of these, you know, non-traditional treatments. But these anecdotal stories, especially when they come from a highly respected genetics researcher such as Dr. Monka, you know, it's fascinating information.
The one thing, this is my opinion. It's not necessarily that. What's amazed me is I have tried to study coaching and talk to the experts and stuff like that. Is science is very interesting. Science will only acknowledge what it can see and can pay attention to, and if you look at time, history is that, you know, we didn't understand the heavens until we had the telescope to see it. It was always there, right? But we didn't see it. And on a micro level, it wasn't until we had the microscope that we could actually see stuff and measure it that had happened. What was fascinating to me about the Dr. Monkey thing is that, you know, Chinese medicine has been around for 2,000 years, and it's been based on outcomes, not based off of what we could see.
Right.
And while we can't necessarily see it, there's an outcome, and we can't necessarily correlate. If you walk in and you have a pain in your lower back, this is going to help you. There's got to be something there to it. But at the same time, I go to the other side of it and go, well, what exactly is it? And there's an attention thing that kind of goes to this, which is going to tee up our next show, because the idea of the outline that I never got to was the mind, and that's information and coaching and CBT and NLP and all that kind of stuff, and your belief systems, because at the end of the day, you can, your brain, your gray matter can be optimized. You could be well rested. You could have exercise. You could, your thyroid could be right. You can have no allergies. You could be all that stuff. You can take medication, but at the end of the day, if your belief systems are not correct, then your brain's not going to actually be optimized. Would you agree, Dr. Ramsey, is that accurate?
I would say yes, that, you know, the belief system, how and tied in with behaviors as well. You know what, those are very often the outcomes. It's usually the behaviors are the outcomes that we're looking for, and our cognitions, our beliefs, our thoughts are intimately tied in with those, and our emotions.
So with that, Dr. Ramsey, again, if you're interested in contacting him, it's Ramsay at mail.upenn.edu. And with that, Dr. Ramsey, thank you very much for coming on the show. This has been spectacular. I hope we can get you back on to do a sequel on this, because it's been, I've learned so much just
no, definitely,
in conversation.
We'll definitely have to do this.
And it's been kind of crazy out there for everybody, but again, I hope you all have a happy Thanksgiving. Catch us next week for another edition of Attention Talk Radio. And again, Dr. Ramsey, thanks for coming on the show.
Very welcome.
Take care, everybody.